As I mentioned last class, there are three major questions that will determine how this war is fought, what this war will end up looking like, and how the world will change. And as I discussed last class, I'm making three predictions about this war. The first is United States will use ground troops. And this will mean that Donald Trump will institute a national draft. Okay? That's the first prediction. Second prediction is that Israel and the United States will not use tactical nuclear weapons in this war. Number three is that the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in the Islamic world, will be destroyed during this war. Okay, so last class, I explained my analysis and my reasoning for my first two predictions. Today, I'll explain my third prediction. So, but before we start, I just want to look at some videos, okay? So you understand some of the context, some of the players in this war. All right, so this is Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut, and he is one of the 100 members of the U.S. Senate. He's also one of the members of the Gang of Eight. Now, when you are fighting a war, the White House has responsibility to report its objectives, its purpose, how the war is progressing to 8 members of Congress in a confidential setting, okay? And this is Senator Blumenthal after he's been debriefed by the White House. Okay, and this is what he has to say about the progress of the war so far.
I emerge from this briefing as dissatisfied and angry, frankly, as I have from any past briefing in my 15 years in the Senate. I am left with more questions than answers, especially about the cost of the war. My questions have been unanswered. And I will demand answers because the American people deserve to know. And I guess I am most concerned about the threat to American lives of potentially deploying our sons and daughters on the ground in Iran. We seem to be on a path toward deploying American troops on the ground in Iran to accomplish any of the potential objectives here. And there is also, as disturbingly as anything else, the specter of active Russian aid to Iran putting in danger American lives.
All right, so three things to take away from his talk with reporters, okay? The first thing is the administration, Donald Trump, the White House, has not articulated a budget. How much will this war cost? Which means that this is an open-ended war. We don't know when this war will end, and so we don't know what the commitment is, and so we don't know how much this war will cost, okay? That's the first point he makes. The second point he makes is we are on a path towards the deployment of ground troops in Iran. Okay, and that basically means a national draft. And the third thing that's crucial is he says that they know for a fact that Russia is already involved in this war, aiding Iran. Okay, so that's the three main takeaways from okay, so this is the foreign minister of Iran, Agachi, talking to NBC News, all right? And NBC News is going to ask Agachi, hey, there's talk in the United States already of ground troops being used against Iran, okay? Now, I want you to observe his response and then the response of the journalists.
President Trump has not ruled out boots on the ground in Iran. Are you afraid of a U.S. invasion in your country?
No, we are waiting for them.
You were waiting for the U.S. military to invade the ground troops?
Yes, because we are confident that we can confront them, and that would be a big disaster for them.
Okay, you understand? Okay.
So you're saying that Iran is ready and willing to take on the U.S. military if there were to be ground troops?
Well, we were ready for this.
Okay, so again, certain things to appreciate. First of all, the foreign minister, Agachi, he is not at all concerned about ground troops. In fact, he basically said, it's a trap for you guys. You come in, we've been preparing for about 20 years for this, we will destroy you. Another thing that you will notice is the journalist is completely surprised by the answer. He's shocked into silence. He has to ask again, wait, are you saying you're ready for ground troops? And so this shows you that within Washington, D.C., okay, within the Trump administration, within the foreign policy elite, within the media elite, they haven't really thought this through out. They really haven't considered the possibility of losing this war. Washington, D.C. right now, it's a bubble, okay? It's an insular bubble where everyone just believes the same things. And that's very problematic if you are to continue fighting this war, okay? All right, let's continue. Okay, this is Rabbi Schneerson, and he is the leader, or he used to be, he's died, but he used to be the leader of an organization called the Shabbat Lubavitch. I'll be talking more about Shabbat Lubavitch as we go along, okay? But I introduce you to him now. This is the year 1990, and he is talking to Benjamin Netanyahu, who is a young and upcoming politician in Israel, okay? And so let's look at the conversation. This is not now, okay? Okay, so what's going on here? Okay, so as an upcoming politician, Netanyahu is going to the rabbi, and the rabbis are the most powerful people in the Jewish society. He basically says, will you give me your blessing? Will you support me in my political endeavors? And the rabbi says, yes. They also talk about how things are progressing. Okay? So another way of saying this is that there's almost like a plan in motion to achieve certain religious objectives. And things are going well. But the rabbi Schneerson says, but they're not going fast enough because we need the Messiah, the great leader of the Jewish people, to come. And we can set in motion things that will force the coming of the Messiah. So let's speed things up, Netanyahu. Okay? So what this is, I'll explain later on, okay? But I want you to be aware of this, who these people are. Rabbi Schneerson is very important for our story. Netanyahu, of course, is the current prime minister of Israel. All right, let's continue. All right.
We want to know what you're reading now.
What I'm reading?
Yeah.
For the Jews against Rome.
What made you pick it up?
Well, we lost that one. I think we have to win the next one.
We want to know what you're reading now.
Okay. All right. So that's a very quick exchange, okay? So a journalist is asking Benjamin Netanyahu, what book are you reading now? And he says, Rome versus the Jews. It's a book by Barry Strauss, a historian. And it goes on about the three wars that the Jews fought against the Romans. And it was essentially a Holocaust for the Jews. A lot of Jews either died or were enslaved. The Romans burned down the Second Temple. So there's this historical animosity of the Jews against the Romans. Okay? What Benjamin Netanyahu said is that I'm reading this book because we lost that war against Rome. But the next war against Rome, we must not lose. The question then is, who's Rome? It's not Iran, guys. It's probably not Russia. It's probably America, right? The great empire. So this is strange because Israel is the ally of America in this war. But Netanyahu is saying that, no, our real enemy is Rome. That's what we must prepare for, okay? So I want you guys to keep this in mind. All right, this is Peter Hegseth, who is the Secretary of War for Donald Trump, okay? And this is the year about 2018, where he is in Jerusalem, and he's talking to Christian Zionists and Zionists, okay? Who these people are, I'll explain later on, okay? But let's listen to his speech really quickly.
And I and others had a chance to go see the Western Wall of the Temple Mount, the Western Wall tunnels, so much of the Old City. And as you stand there, you can't help but behold the miracle before you. And it got me thinking about another miracle that I hope all of you don't see too far away. Because 1917 was a miracle. 1948 was a miracle. 1967 was a miracle. 2017, the declaration of Jerusalem as the capital was a miracle. And there's no reason why the miracle of the reestablishment of the temple on the Temple Mount is not possible.
Okay, so he is a Christian. He's not a Jew. But what he's saying is that he's come to Jerusalem and he's visited these Jewish holy sites. And he can't help be amazed, be awed by the beauty, the spirituality of the Western Wall. He also goes on to say that there's been a series of miracles, okay? So 1917 was the Balfour Declaration, when basically the British Empire permitted the Jews to found the nation state of Israel. 1948 was when Israel was founded. 1967 was when when Israel fought a war against its Arab neighbors and won. Okay, and 2017 was when Donald Trump transferred the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, thus recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And what he's saying is that, well, if this is a series of steps to achieving a divine plan, then the next miracle should be the rebuilding of Solomon's temple, the third temple, and that means destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Okay? So what's going on here? Okay, again, I'll explain to you later on, but I want you to be aware of who these people are and how they think. All right, let's go one more video. And so if you want to build Solomon's temple, if you want to build the third temple, you need to get rid of the third holiest site in the Islamic world. And how do you do that? Well, there are some options, okay? So
missiles will hit the mosque and clear the place for the third Beit HaMikdash. That could also be a miracle. If it was up to me, the last time when they shot hundreds of missiles, I would pretend that one missile came from Iran and shoot it down. You know, then all the Arabs will go against Iran and it will be the end of the problems. You make them fight with each other, this bunch of lunatics. Never too late. You deal with a bunch of cowards.
Okay, so this is a rabbi in Israel. He's saying how last year, during the 12-day war in June, Iran was fire missiles at Israel. And what he's saying is, you know, that was an opportunity for us to pretend that Iranian missile hit the Dome of the Rock, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, thus destroying it. And then the Arabs will blame the Iranians, and the Arabs will go to war against the Persians. And then we can just sit back and laugh at these lunatics. Okay? So, again, this may be confusing to you as to who these people are, why they are saying these things. All right? But now what I'm going to do is explain to you what is really going on. Okay? And I keep on saying this, but it is hard from a geopolitical perspective to explain this US-Iran war. You have to look at the religious perspective, okay? The religious angle, and that's what I want to focus on today. Okay. Sorry. Okay, so again, this is the three holiest sites in the Islamic world. This is Saudi Arabia, Mecca, Medina, and this is the Dome of the Rock, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is where Muhammad was supposed to ascend to heaven. And the Jews and the Christian Zionists believe that this must be destroyed so that they can build the third temple, or Solomon's temple, okay? All right, so this is the big question in this war. And again, I keep on saying this, but I need to be right in my prediction if my analysis is to be correct. If they do not destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and if they are able to achieve peace, then my predictive model, my analysis is completely wrong, and you just ignore me, okay, for the rest of my life. I can go back to teaching, you know, great books or something. All right, so let us examine why this is important, okay? So today I want to introduce you to a new theory of game theory called the law of eschatological convergence. Okay, so this is a very hard thing to write down, okay? It sounds complicated, but it's not, okay? Eschatology, what it is a story of how the world ends. And it's very compelling for people because, remember, we discussed this last semester, but as human beings, we have three questions. Where did we come from? Why are we here? Where are we going? And eschatology provides a story that answers all three questions. Why God created us, what our mission on earth is, and what God has planned for the end of the world. Okay? And different traditions will have different eschatologies. And what's important to figure out is, in what aspect do these eschatologies converge? Okay, converge, meaning a union of these eschatologies. And why is that important? Because it allows you to predict how they will behave. Think of a story as the operating system of a society. And as such, it's a script that they will act out. And if you're able to figure out the different scripts and see how they converge together, where the union of these different scripts are, then you can actually predict how the world will turn out. Okay? All right. So, having explained the law, I'm going to go into some theory to help us understand why this works. Okay? All right. So, the first thing to understand is something called the universal law of game theory. Okay? And the universal law of game theory states this. Whoever wins a game is able to do this, okay? Mass times energy times coordination. Okay? So these are the three things you want to look at to understand how well a player would do in a game. So mass is just the number of people involved on the team. Okay? Energy is just how much attention, focus, motivation there is. Okay? So think of it as attention or motivation or action. Okay? Any of these words will do. But basically, how invested are you in winning the game? And how hard are you willing to work to win the game? And coordination is just the idea of synchronicity. And what I mean by that is how well do the teammates work together? Okay? And something that you need to appreciate is that the most important thing in winning a game is actually coordination. In fact, I would say it's four times more important than just mass. So you can have a lot of people, but if they don't work well together, you're defeated by another team with few people, but they work well together, okay? And then energy is twice as important as mass, all right? So let me give you an example. Let's just say that you're playing a game by yourself. Okay, maybe for example, you enter a ping pong competition or a chess competition. Well, mass and coordination don't really matter because you don't have any teammates. And so what matters is energy, how motivated you are to win this game. How much time do you put in practice? How much time do you put into studying and improving yourself? How focused are you in winning, okay? All right, so a team sport, mass is constant. And so what matters is energy and coordination, how well the team works well together, okay? Now, what's interesting is that there are different ways to improve or increase, augment the energy and coordination, all right? So maybe a leader. Okay, so maybe if someone is a really inspiring leader, that will make people much more motivated. And that will allow them to work well together because all they have to do is listen to a leader. Okay? The problem with a leader, of course, is that eventually he will die. All right? Then you have a family. Okay, blood. Okay? They work well together because they all share similar blood. But we cannot account for the differences within this family, okay, the conflict within this family, right? So historically, in the long term, the force that allows teams to beat other teams is the idea of narrative, okay? Narrative, or a story, okay? Why? Because it implants in the minds of all those who believe in the narrative, a series of actions that they must take in order to win the game, okay? So think of it as a script. And in a script, you know what part you play, so you just have to act it out. And that allows for you all to work together to achieve the outcome that you desire, okay? Does that make sense? Okay? And in narrative, the most powerful form of narrative is the idea of eschatology. Because eschatology is a complete script. A complete script in which everyone knows what he or she must do in order to achieve the desired outcome. And eschatology also is able to transcend both time and space, meaning that you can actually spend centuries acting out the script because everyone knows his role anyway, okay? And it can transcend borders as well. You can go beyond ethnic identity and family, okay? So the most powerful mechanism in history is eschatology, right? So what is eschatology? All right, so most religions are similar. Most religions require you to be a good person be humble, be kind, be generous. But there are certain aspects of religions that are extreme, okay? And we can call them eschatologies. Okay? So the classic example is the Jewish religion. Okay? In the Jewish religion, if you're what you believe is that you no longer live in Israel because a long time ago, the Israelites pissed off God by disobeying him. God told the Israelites, do not worship false idols. But the Israelites sinned, they disobeyed, so they were kicked out of Jerusalem. And they were forced to wander the earth in the diaspora for centuries. And so what they believe is that they each need to engage in an act of redemption, of humility, of submission, of piety to God, if they are to redeem the whole Jewish people. Okay? And when that happens, when they recognize their own limitations, when they recognize how inferior they are to God and submit to God, then God will send the Messiah to redeem them and lead them back to Jerusalem, defeat the enemies of the Jews, bring all the Jews from the diaspora back to Jerusalem, unify the Jewish people, and then build the third temple so that God can come to earth and live with all the Jews and create heaven on earth, okay? That is the Jewish religion that most Jews believe. Okay, like there are a lot of differences, okay? But I'm just trying to simplify it for clarity, okay? But then you have these extremes, fanatics, who have a different eschatology, okay? And these people, we can say, are accelerationists. And their point is that this is fine, but it's way too slow. And it dissolves us of individual responsibility. If you have faith in God, then you should want to hurry things up and force the return of God as soon as possible. And you do that by recognizing that if you actually, before the Messiah comes, if you actually go and create the nations of Israel, bring all the Jews back, build the third temple, defeat all the enemies, then the Messiah will come naturally. Okay? And so, of course, most Jews hear this and they think that this is blasphemy, it's heresy. Because you are defying the will of God. You think you can manipulate God into action. That is wrong. That is the opposite of redemption. That is the worst possible sin you can make. Okay? And so this eschatology is considered a fringe, an extreme, something to be ignored. The problem, though, is that if you think about it, what an eschatology really is doing is creating a vector to force the religion to move in a certain direction. Okay? And also, if you think about it, if this is the case where eschatology is a vector that forces the mainstream to move in a certain direction, then whichever eschatology is the most extreme, the most violent, will be the one that wins out. Okay? Okay, does that make sense? In other words, what we're going to do today is look at the most extreme versions of different eschatologies. Because, quite honestly, even though these extreme versions are shared by only a few people, they're the ones who are working the hardest to achieve their eschatology, and therefore they're forcing the religion they are in to move a certain way. Okay? All right. So, you hear this and you think this is all confusing, but what I'm going to do now is I'm going to share with you a passage from a biography of Rabbi Snierson. Remember, we had a look at Rabbi Snierson talking to Netanyahu and saying, hurry up, let's hurry up the return of the Messiah, okay? He is in charge of Shabbat Lubavitch, which again is an extreme eschatology. But again, because they are so extreme, They're willing to work as hard as possible to achieve their vision, and therefore they are forcing the Jewish mainstream in a certain direction. Okay? All right, so this is a biography of Rabbi Schneerson. And the Shabbat Lubavitch movement was founded in modern-day Belarus. And over time, it went over to America because it suffered a lot of persecution by the Russians. And today, they are a global movement. And they are powerful in Russia, in America, and in Israel. Okay? So we will discuss the Shabbat Lubavitch as we move along. But I want to, with this passage, show you how coordination among eschatologists work. Okay? All right? So the year is 1939. And the Nazi Germany, again, who are anti-Semitic, they hate Jews. They want all Jews out of Europe. They are overrunning Europe. And by 1939, they have conquered Poland, Warsaw. Okay? Now, Poland, Warsaw is where the head rabbi, the Rebbe, of the Shabbat Lubavitch movement is. And his name is Yosef Yetzat. Okay? And he's the father-in-law of Rabbi Schneerson. And he's an old man, and he's in Warsaw, and the Nazis are overrunning the city. So his followers in America are want to save his life, okay? So then the question then is, like, but how do you do that? Because America and Germany are not best friends. The war is breaking out in Europe. And Yosef Yewitz is a very old man. And there are no planes, well, there are planes, but there are no commercial air flights that you can take, okay? So it's gonna be a very long, arduous journey across many borders. Plus, he will need a visa, not just for himself, but for his whole family, okay? Now what I'll show you is how powerful these people are. And again, this is an eschatology where they all share similar vision, and therefore they're willing to make the necessary sacrifices in order to help each other achieve this vision, okay? All right, so this is from the biography. An ocean away in America, Yosef Yetzirah's followers were mounting a rescue effort. With the help of Sam Kramer, an Orthodox attorney, the son of Lubavitch immigrants, the Shabbat activist Israel Jacobson hired Max Rohn, a politically connected lawyer, to secure American visas for Yosef Yewitz and his family, okay? So, in other words, even though there may not be that many followers, they have a wide political circle. And a lot of the reason why is that they pull their resources together. And when they pull their resources together, they're able to invest in real estate together, they're able to invest in business together, and they're able to generate a lot of money, which they can then use to influence politics in America, okay? They can buy out politicians, they can do a lot of things. Okay, so the first part is easy, getting visas for the rabbi and his family. Now the problem is, how do you actually get to him, okay? Because there are no telephones, there's no internet, there are no airplanes. How do you find him when there's a war going on in Poland, when there are Nazis everywhere? Okay, all right, let's continue. Yosef Yewitz followers also reached out to Attorney General Benjamin Cohen, okay, and Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, okay? This man is very important. He's what we call a Sabbatine Francus. What I'll show you later on is that Sabbatine Francus and the Shabbat Lubavitch movement are very much aligned. Okay, so even though they're not part of the same movement, they are sympathetic towards each other. And he's the most powerful Jew in America at this time, okay, in the 1930s, 40s, whom Yosef Yewitz had met during his fundraising trip of 1929. The Lubavitch efforts in America were successful, all right? So they won over the Americans. They won over the entire American political apparatus, and they are dedicated to helping the rabbi escape Europe and come to America. All right? Now, the second part is, how do you deal with the Nazis? Okay. The Lubavitch's efforts in America were successful. On October 2nd, Cohen wrote to Robert Pell, a senior official in the State Department, asking for help. The next day, Pell contacted Helmuth Wattard, a German and a member of the Nazi Party, a Nazi, who specialized in national industry and economics, to see if he would be willing to save one of the leading Jewish scholars in the world. Okay? This is a guy, American, writing to a Nazi and saying, hey man, I know you're a Nazi, but we need your help to save a Jew. And the guy says, yes. Okay? Wattard was strategically chosen. He had studied at Columbia University in the early 1930s and had forged a relationship with Pell after the Evian Conference on Jewish Refugees in 1938. Seeing an opportunity to curry goodwill of the United States, Wattard secretly contacted Admiral William Kanaras, the head of German military intelligence. Wow! The head of German military intelligence. And saying, hey man, let's help this guy. Canaris, a skeptical Nazi who disapproved of SS atrocities and thought the invasion of Poland a mistake, enlisted Major Ernst Bloch, a distinguished veteran of World War I and one of the most trusted officers. Bloch was a Mischling. Okay, a Mischling just means a German who had some Jewish ancestry, but because he was so valorous in World War I, he was considered a German. Okay? He had been declared of German blood by Hitler in 1939. Along with three other soldiers, two of whom were also Mischling, Bloch was instructed to find Josef Jetzet and bring him to safety. Wow. The Nazis, okay, dispatched their own soldiers to find this guy and bring him to America. And this is, again, during war. But how do you find this guy? Bloch and his colleagues had to maneuver through the ruins of Warsaw without arousing the suspicions of the SS to find a rabbi who did not know of their mission and did not want to be found. Okay, so this rabbi is hiding from everyone. So how do you find this guy? And he's deadly afraid of all German soldiers because he sees them as just Nazis. This is another problem. Well, Jews in the city were naturally unwilling to divulge the location of a Hasidic leader to a Nazi officer. Eventually, the information came from the Americans. Brandeis was informed of Josef Jetzet's address by the Shabbat lawyer Arthur Rabinowitz and relayed it via Cohen and Pell to the U.S. Charge of Affairs in Germany. This requires a coordination of dozens and dozens of people who are supposed to be on the opposite side of a war. And they're working together to achieve a goal. At the end of November, Bloch found Josef Jetzet's apartment and after some confusion, convinced the residents he was there to help. Once he had obtained few coupons, train tickets, and military clearances for SS checkpoints, Bloch loaded Josef Jetzet and his family onto a truck and headed for the train station. There, the family received first-class tickets and boarded a train filled with Nazi officials and soldiers. Okay, and that's how they got him out. In other words, they are able to work above the bureaucracy of different nation states in order to achieve their eschatological goal. Okay? All right. Does it make sense? All right. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into the idea of eschatological convergence. Because once we know the different eschatologies and we know how they converge together, we can actually make certain predictions about how this war will progress. Okay, so the first major eschatology I want to look at is called Zoroastrianism. And this is the first eschatology. And it's an eschatology of the Persian Empire, okay? And this eschatology is very simple. In the world, there's truth and the lie, okay? The light and the darkness. And it is our responsibility as humans to live for the light, to die for the truth against the lie. And at the end of days, there will be a final battle and a day of judgment, okay? So light versus dark, and then you have a day of judgment. Okay, where the god Ahura Mazda will come down and he will create a paradise for everyone. Okay, so what matters is to live a noble life and await the day of judgment where eventually heaven on earth will manifest. Okay, And this is important because if you think about how the Iranians are fighting this war, the Iranians refuse to take the initiative and destroy too much, okay? They refuse to be the villains in this war because for them, in their eschatology, it's important to die for the light, to fight for the truth, okay? Now, Zoroastrianism has a major impact on Jewish eschatology, okay? And Jewish eschatology, again, I'm only talking about the most extreme version of this eschatology, okay? And in this eschatology, the idea is that the Jews disobeyed God, okay? Disobedience. And in order to repair the world, to save themselves, to create heaven on earth, they need to engage in redemption, okay? Redemption. And redemption is really about spiritual alchemy, improving yourself as a person, being good to yourself, being good to others, loving your neighbor as though you would love yourself. Okay, that's a mainstream idea. But in the most extreme version, redemption just means acting out God's plan to compel the return of Messiah. Okay, and this plan is basically create Israel, return Jewish diaspora, build third temple, and this will often call the War of Gog and Magog. And then when the Jews are most threatened, the Messiah will come to save them from their enemies. And this will create something called the Messianic Age, okay? When God rules over the earth through his Messiah, who comes from the house of David. Okay, all right. So again, this is a simple version. There are lots of different versions. This is the most simple version for our purposes, okay? Now, what's interesting is that this Jewish eschatology would go on to influence the Protestants, okay? And this creates a movement called Christian Zionism. Christian Zionism. So the technical word for Christian Zionism is called premillennial dispensationalism. Okay, and this sounds very complicated, but it's not. All it means is that God has a plan for how to create heaven on earth, and we have a duty to fulfill his plan by following his instructions. Okay? All right. So what Christian Zionism is doing is that it takes this Jewish eschatology and makes certain changes to it. Okay? So, for example, the first change that it makes is, okay, this plan is fine, but rather than say that the Jewish Messiah is the representative of God, what they say is that, no, he's actually the representative of Satan. Okay? So the Messiah, in the Jewish tradition, becomes the Antichrist in the Christian Zionist tradition. And why is this important? It's important because for the Christians, the Messiah must be Jesus, okay? So the Messiah, the Antichrist, what he does is that he rules over the world. He's very charismatic and he rules the world in Jerusalem. And he starts the War of Gog and Magog, in order to conquer the world and destroy the Jews. Now, at this point, Jesus will return to save God's chosen people, the Jews. And when Jesus returns, there'll be something called the rapture, where all Christians will immediately ascend to heaven. Okay? So the rapture. All right. Okay? So again, Christian Zionism is working off Jewish eschatology, but it's making some important changes, okay? So another way of saying this is, in the beginning, Zionists and Christian Zionists will work together to reach a certain point of history, okay, what we call the Greater Israel Project, but then they will diverge and fight against each other, okay? So they're allies now, but eventually they'll turn against each other. All right, so now I want to talk about the Freemasons. Because the Freemasons, we'll talk more about the Freemasons later, okay? The Freemasons are also working within the Christian Zionist context. But they are much more focused on actually how to implement this, okay? So what they want to do is they want to take the Antichrist and turn it into a system. And this system we discussed last semester, it's called Pax Judaica. What is Pax Judaica? Pax Judaica is that Israel controls the world through AI, okay, an AI surveillance state. Okay? Or their exact words is Holy Empire. Okay? And Pax Judaica, the Israelite state, will have things such as the Mark of the Beast. And what is the Mark of the Beast? It is digital ID. Okay? And this digital ID will also lead to digital currency. And they can actually put a microchip or a QR bar in your forehead. And this will be considered the Mark of the Beast, okay? And it's all part of the Christian Zionist eschatology. Another really important thing about the Freemasons is the idea of a one world government. Because remember, the Antichrist is the leader of a one world government. And it'll be based in Jerusalem, okay? And so the headquarters will be Solomon's Temple or the Third Temple. All right, okay. So these are the, and then you have the Islamic eschatology, okay? In the Islamic eschatology is a response to all these other eschatologies where they say that when the system is created, it'll be called Dajjal, the Antichrist, okay? And when this happens, then Jesus will return to defeat the Antichrist. Okay, that's the mainstream Islamic eschatology. Then you have the Shia. Okay, the Shia are the Iranians, where they believe that it will be the 12th Imam Mahdi who will lead the followers. Okay, the Umrah. Okay, Umrah just means community of believers, to believers into victory against the Antichrist, the Dajjal, okay? So you can see how these eschatologists are basically lining up together, right? The Shia are the Iranians. The Islamic is the entire Arab world, right? Now, there are two more eschatologies I want to look at. And again, I know this is a lot. I know this is too much information. And we'll go over these eschatologies specifically as we move along, okay? But I just want to introduce the different eschatologies. Another eschatology that's very important is the Catholic eschatology. And in the Catholic eschatology, we can call City of God, okay, which is the church, which is Jerusalem. And St. Augustine talks about this, about how the Catholic Church, it is the millennium, it is the Messianic Age, because we represent God. And we bring peace and prosperity to the world. Now, what's important about the church is that it became the dominant power in the world because Rome fell. Okay? So, Roman Empire collapses. But this is all part of God's divine plan because Roman Empire, Rome, was the city of earth, okay, of power, of money, of wealth. And what matters is Jerusalem, the city of God, of spirituality, of divinity, okay? Now, the city of God came to an end because of the rise of the Protestants and the Anglo-American Empire. So for the Catholic Church to achieve its eschatology and establish, again, the city of God, what they need to do is also see the Anglo-American Empire destroyed, just like the Roman Empire. Okay? So that is the Catholic eschatology. The last eschatology I want to discuss is the Orthodox eschatology. And what's the Orthodox eschatology? The Russians, okay? And this is called the Third Rome Prophecy. Okay? The Third Rome Prophecy is basically that Moscow will become the Third Rome. Okay, the first Rome, the first Rome was Rome, second Rome was Constantinople, and the third Rome will be Moscow. And also, what's really important to appreciate is that there will be no fourth Rome. So when Moscow becomes the third Rome, history ends. Okay, and peace and prosperity will come to the world. Okay, so what does this mean? It means that Russia will unite the Orthodox world. Okay, so right now the Orthodox world is split into Eastern Orthodoxy and Greek Orthodoxy. Okay, and something that is very important that this prophecy says is that the Russians will defeat Turkey in a war and then have the Greeks return to Constantinople, which is modern-day Istanbul. Okay, that's what the prophecy says. And so you look at all these different eschatologies, okay? And again, guys, this is the majority of the world, right? If you actually look at the convergence points, you come to some startling conclusions, okay? So let's look at the convergence. All right, where do they converge, okay? Well, first of all, okay, where they converge is that the greater Israel project will be achieved, okay? Pax Judaica will be achieved. It's a one world government, okay? One world government. That is one major convergence. If that's true, then another convergence is the Al-Aqsa Mosque will give way to the Third Temple. All these eschatologies either say this or are indifferent to saying this, okay? They're not opposed to this, all right? So that's why I predict the Al-Aqsa Mosque will be destroyed because they need to build a third temple. Another thing in which they converge is the rise of anti-Semitism. Why? Because that will force the diaspora, the Jewish diaspora, to return to Israel. And this is very important for this eschatology, okay? All right. Another important convergence point is the war of Gog and Magog. We don't actually know what this is, but this war is supposed to be the final war before the return of God, before the end of history, before the end of the world, okay? What this war is, we don't know yet. But another thing this is that this war in Iran will lead to the war of Gog and Magog at some point. Okay? What this war is, we'll discuss at a later time. Another thing that's very important is US and China are not part of this eschatology. Okay? This is where everyone agrees. For whatever reason, the United States is not going to partake in future events. Neither will China. Which means that something will happen to these two countries that will make them not significant anymore, okay? And the best prediction for the United States then is civil war, right? Okay, civil war. Okay, and this is where all these eschatologies converge. So in other words, this war in Iran is happening so that these different eschatological traditions can achieve heaven on earth from their perspective, all right? So what this means, so given this convergence, we can actually predict certain events that will happen over the next 2 to 4 years, okay? Because they all want these things to happen together, all right? So let's look at some quick predictions. Okay. First prediction, of course, is that the U.S. will use ground troops. Because using ground troops will create a national draft. And what does a national draft do? It creates a civil war, right? A lot of young people are going to refuse to fight in this war. And this is going to create protests. Then America will have no choice but to deploy the National Guard. And this will create the recipe for a lot of civil conflict in America. Okay? Another thing that will happen is because you use ground troops, you will lose the war, and then CENTCOM, which is the American military in the Middle East, will then transfer over to Israel. Okay? What's happening in this war is that the economies of the GCC are being destroyed. And that's part of the plan. Okay? Because for Israel to achieve the Greater Israel Project, it needs to absorb the GCC and parts of Turkey and parts of Egypt. Okay? So another way of saying this is that the GCC is basically finished. The intention is to collapse their economies and make them irrelevant. Right? The third thing we can expect is that Turkey will enter this war, and Saudi Arabia actually will enter the war. Because you want to use this war to weaken opposition to these eschatologies as much as possible. Okay? So Turkey and Saudi Arabia will enter this war, and they will suffer tremendously because of their participation. All right. Again, the Al-Aqsa Mosque will be destroyed. Okay? And then you have the rise of Persia. Okay? The rise of Persia. Why is this important? Because you need the Islamic world to unite against Israel for the end of days. Right? So you don't mind if actually Iran wins this war, because by winning this war, Iran will activate its Persian identity. And this is important for eschatology, because in the war of Gog and Magog, people are interpreting Gog and Magog, which will march against Israel, they're interpreting Gog and Magog to be Persia and Russia. Okay? Okay? Together they will march against Pax Judaica. Number six is that in Israel, you will achieve the Pax Judaica and the Greater Israel Project. Okay, so the Greater Israel Project and Pax Judaica are not the same thing, guys. Greater Israel is just basically the territory that the Israelis believed that God had promised their ancestor Abraham. Pax Judaica is a one world government, okay, based on AI surveillance and the mark of the beast. So what will happen is that Israel will use this war to expand its territory, and then what will happen is that capital, technology, will then start to flow to Israel in order to create the Pax Judaica. So think of companies like NVIDIA, Oracle, Microsoft, Google. Well, they'll probably transfer themselves to Israel, because that is where the power will rest. Okay? So Pax Judaica. Then you will have Russia winning the war in Ukraine, okay? And then return Greeks to Constantinople. Basically, another way of saying this is, it is possible that the Greeks go to war against Turkey, and then Russia supports the Greeks and return the Greeks to Istanbul, okay? But then you're like, wait a minute, Turkey is a NATO member. Well, we can also expect destruction of Europe, okay? The end of NATO, basically. So this war in Ukraine, it's not just about Russia protecting its borders. This war in Ukraine is also meant to achieve Orthodox eschatology, to destroy Europe, to destroy NATO, so that Russia can achieve the Third Rome Prophecy. That means the destruction of Europe. So I will discuss the Russian-Ukraine war later on as we go along, okay? But what I'm trying to show you is that just by, okay, analyzing the most extreme eschatologies of different religious traditions, you can then, from this analysis, pick out points in which they agree. Okay? And at these points, you can figure out then how they will affect current geopolitics to make certain predictions about how the war will progress, about how the world will transform itself in the next 2 to 4 years. Okay? So this is called the law of eschatological convergence. It gives us tremendous insight into why things are turning out the way they are. Okay? Because again, I keep on saying this, but purely from a geopolitical perspective, purely from a realpolitik perspective, this war in Iran makes no sense. But if you look at it from an eschatological perspective, then it makes perfect sense. Okay? Any questions? Yes.
But I think, like, if we look into the war between America and Iran, I think Trump is trying to destroy Iran as the same way that he destroys Venezuela, but it fails, which led Iran to fight back. So I think this could also explain in a political way, but not religious.
Okay. All right, that's a great point in that, listen, there's an explanation, which is that Trump is just stupid. He's arrogant. They had too much success in Venezuela. They go into Iran, and they think it's the same thing. And now they're losing, okay? And because they're losing, they are just panicking, okay? Okay, that's true. And if this explanation is true, then what will happen, what we can expect to happen is that Trump declares victory and goes home. Okay, that's what we can expect. And if the U.S. does go home, then you're right. Okay, so we can expect. But sorry, the question then is, what happens next few months? All right, what you need to understand is this: war is not simple. Once you start a war, you can't end the war. All right, so let me explain really quickly why. Okay. So, you have Iran, and the main thing, the main advantage that Iran has over the United States is the GCC cannot defend itself, okay? Because it's just a desert, and Iran, it's a mountain fortress, so it can shoot rockets, it can shoot drones at the GCC, and the GCC can't defend itself, okay? Before, they thought these U.S. bases could defend against Iran, but now you recognize these U.S. bases can't defend themselves either, okay? All right, so the other thing that Iran did was close off the Strait of Hormuz. Okay, they closed off the Strait of Hormuz. And this is important because the GCC then exports oil to Asia and gets back food, okay? So the GCC basically requires the Strait of Hormuz in order just to survive, okay? Now, let's just say that U.S. Donald Trump's like, you know what, screw this. This is a stupid war. The Middle East is stupid. We're going to go home. Okay? What happens now? What happens is that Iran says to GCC, hey man, you attacked us. You destroyed our infrastructure. You destroyed our economy. You have to pay a compensation. Okay? Right? Also, hey man, now we control the Strait of Hormuz. So if you want to use Strait of Hormuz, you have to pay us a toll. You have to pay us a tax. Right? So all this money of the GCC, before it's going to the United States to fuel the U.S. economy, now where does it go? It goes to Iran. Right? That's a lot of money, man. We're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars. And what will Iran use with this money? It will use its money, this money, to repair its economy. So in 5 to 10 years, this is going to be an economic miracle. Where now Iran is able to industrialize really fast. And as a result, what's going to happen? What's going to happen is that if the United States leaves the Middle East, Iran becomes the superpower and controls the entire Middle East. Right? Now, Israel has nuclear weapons. And so what's going to happen is that Israel and Iran will sign a peace treaty. Okay? But the United States won't be involved. The United States goes home, it doesn't get any money from the GCC, or what's going to happen to the U.S. economy? It's going to collapse. Why? Because the entire U.S. economy is based on the stock market, on finance, on AI, on investment from the GCC. Right? So the question then is, can the Americans go home? The answer is, no, they can't. Because if they go home, their economy is going to collapse, and the people are going to have a revolution anyway. So you're better off sending people to Iran than have the people in America cause a revolution. Right? Okay? So you're right in that it's possible that Donald Trump made a mistake, but it doesn't matter if it was intentional or accidental. You have the same outcome. And strangely enough, this outcome that you have matches that, aligns with these different eschatologies in the world. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, all right. Any more questions? All right, okay. So we'll continue this next week, guys, okay?